looking for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom in the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. The new phrase when you're around Dick Cheney is duck. We'll get into that as we continue with the hour. Also coming up on the program, Leonard Steinhorn is going to be here in defense of the baby boom generation, the death of the American dream. And do you want your company to plant an electronic tag in you? Yes, it's really happening right now. And did Cheney say that shooting a fellow hunter was based on faulty intelligence? That and more as we get into our program today. First, however, Andrew Bernstein is with us. Andrew Bernstein is an adjunct professor of philosophy at the State University of New York at Purchase, who chose him outstanding faculty member for 2004. Well, congratulations, Andrew. He's also the author of three Ayn Rand titles for Cliff Notes, Atlas Shrugged, The Fountainhead, and Anthem and the Penguins, Teacher's Guide to the Fountainhead. And Andrew, you have a new book out, don't you?
I sure do, Tom. The Capitalist Manifesto, the historic, economic, and philosophic case for laissez-faire. And if I remember correctly, we discussed it on your show, and your listeners can certainly get it from Amazon or BarnesandNoble.com.
There you go. And Ayn Rand, AynRand.org, the website.
And mine is AndrewBernstein.net.
AndrewBernstein.net, that works too. Okay, great. And Andrew Bernstein, for our listeners, the Ayn Rand's philosophy, and primarily in Atlas Shrugged, but also in her Defense of Selfishness. What was the exact title of that thing?
The Virtue of Selfishness.
The Virtue of Selfishness, thank you. Put forward a way of viewing the world, a way of thinking that you certainly echo in your defense of laissez-faire capitalism, in your Capitalist Manifesto, your new book, which has powerfully influenced created the Objectivist movement, and then powerfully influenced the Libertarian movement, and now also powerfully influences the conservative movement, particularly what is often referred to as the extreme right wing of the conservative movement, at least economically, the Grover Norquists of the world. And I realize that you disavow yourself from them, but just to put this in context. And Andrew Bernstein, you recently suggested, and it's what I wanted to get you on the air and talk about, that environmentalism is causing terrorism. Help me put this picture together. What am I missing here?
Well, I mean, the essence of the environmentalist is that the movement prefers pristine wilderness to human civilization. Human beings, in order to survive and flourish on this earth, we need to transform our environment. We need to build cities, and we need to have factories, and we need to manufacture the consumer goods our lives require. We need medical research. And the environmentalist movement basically prefers pristine wilderness, and the eco-terrorists we see who attack, whether they're animal rights supporters or overt environmentalists, they attack medical research laboratories that do research on mice and rats. They'll attack logging companies or ski resorts. They do not value human civilization, Tom. They prefer what they call a wild earth or a pristine wilderness.
Andy, I would suggest that what you are saying is the same thing as saying Muslims all are in favor of suicide bombing. It is such a wild hyper generalization that it not only does it not illuminate the truth, it obfuscates the truth. I mean, I'm an environmentalist. I've written books about environmentalism, Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, among others. I've never advocated anything other than cooperating with nature. I'm not suggesting we should do away with our cities, and I don't think I've never met an environmentalist who characterizes environmentalism in the context you do, and I've spoken at conferences all over the world on this topic.
Well, I don't think that all environmentalists support eco-terrorism, nor do I think all Muslims support Islamist terrorism.
But you just said that.
No, I said the essence of... Well, let me clarify that. What I'm saying is that the essence of the environmentalist movement, when you strip away the sugar candy coating about you know, preventing air pollution or cleaning up the water pollution or whatever it is. The essence of the environmentalist movement is an attack on the requirements of human civilization.
I'd say it's the exact opposite, Andy. The essence of the environmentalist movement, is that we are part of nature. There is this bizarre, I'd say pathological, psycho and social pathological mindset that believes that somehow humans are separate from nature, that we're different from nature, that we can do without nature. But the fact of the matter is that we are animals and we do live in nature. Here we are. We require food that has to be grown under sunlight, in air, with water. We require food and water and air and these things. And as part of nature, it's incumbent upon us to keep nature as diverse as possible, to ensure biodiversity to the extent that it's possible, to keep nature relatively clean and pristine. If for no other reason, the purely selfish one, that we don't want to be contaminating the nest in which we are growing ourselves.
Well, I agree that man is part of nature, and I think that our nature requires us, like I said before, to chop down forests, to grow crops, to build cities, we have to dig mines and build factories in order to manufacture the goods our life requires. And I think it's the environmentalists who see man as outside of nature, because their viewpoint is that what man's nature requires, the transformation of the environment, is somehow an assault on the earth. And that is simply fantastic. Our nature requires us to transform the earth, to transform our environment. Furthermore, I think if industrial civilization were truly dangerous to human life on earth, you would see the life expectancy starting to decline. And they are not. They're continuing to rise. And in fact, stem cell research is going to take it up into triple digits in this century. Technological advance promotes human life, and I think environmentalists assault that, and I think they're anti-human life.
Well, you raise a whole bunch of different issues here, but the bottom line is, really, this is one of gray areas, Andy. I mean, at what point are you saying that we could just chop down all the forests? That if we just went into Brazil, for example, and did to Brazil what has been done to much of Europe, for example, the, you know, very little forest left, that would be just fine with you?
I'm not a scientist, Tom. There may be some basis for forests promoting human life on Earth, but I don't think
that's what environmentalists are saying.
But I don't think that chopping down forests necessarily, you know, to grow trees for timber, I don't think that necessarily means that you don't replant the trees. Look what the lumber companies have done in the United States. I mean, it's in their rational self-interest to replant trees.
I think a lot of environmentalists are all in favor of appropriate forest management. On the other hand, and the maintenance of wild areas, because there are some, yeah, I mean, you know, tree farms, there are some things that you're simply not going to get. There's certain levels of biodiversity that are not going to exist, and we have an obligation, I think, to maintain those. If, again, at the most selfish level, for example, the Pacific yew tree, it was nearly extinct when they discovered that the Native Americans had been using it for 10,000 years to treat breast cancer, and now they make Taxol out of the stuff. And we wouldn't have known if we had allowed that tree to go extinct.
Well, one of the points I want to make, though, Tom, is that I think technological advance and industrialization is good for the environment. I think it cleanses the environment. The obvious example is that we have the technology to build sewer systems and to have reservoirs, and we have the technology to have a network of...
We also have the technology, Andrew, to live more lightly on the earth. I mean, let's hope that we move in that direction.
This is what cleanses the environment. You don't have people dying of cholera and dysentery and because, without technology...
Well, it sounds like you're being an environmentalist.
But Tom, without these things, but technology is the god here that promotes human life, because without them, it's literally impossible.
So given a choice between a world with...
Animal feces.
I understand all that. Given a choice between a world with all technology and no forests, or no technology and all forests, you'd take the all technology and no forests.
If that was the only alternative, because that would promote human life, but that's not the only alternative. And by the way, one of the ways to promote forest is private property. I mean, if people value forest, they can buy up the land, whether it's the Sierra Club or Earth First or whoever it is, buy up the land.
Well, the Bush administration is trying to do this right now. They're trying to sell off our public lands like crazy. They're telling us out here in Oregon that they're going to sell off the national forests so that the counties can pay for their schools for 5 years. The national forests so that the counties can pay for their schools for 5 years.
Yeah, but like I said...
But at the end of 5 years, it's like it's gone.
But people can... If you have a private property system, private individuals or organizations can buy the land and then arrogate it to whatever purpose they want, including parks or even just to keep it pristine and have no human beings in there. It's their property. Private property protects everybody, including the environmentalists. That's what's great about capitalism and the principle of individual rights.
And so we should have no national forests.
Not run by the government, but I think private individuals or private companies can have forests and parks.
So we should just privatize all our national forests. We should privatize Yellowstone.
You should privatize everything except the military and the police force. We know from the history of capitalism that private enterprise is productive, much more efficiently than any government could ever be.
Fascinating. Andy Bernstein, AYNRAND.org or AndrewBernstein.net, the websites. Andy, thanks for being with us this morning.
Always good talking to you, Tom. Take care.
Ditto, Andy. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the True People's Radio.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Yeah, let's just privatize everything. And indeed, come on. This is absolutely what is happening right now here in the Pacific Northwest. We have the federal government coming along and saying, well, you know, we'll just sell off all this land. And we've got a bunch of counties that can't afford to pay for their schools. And so Bush comes along and says, well, you know, we'll just sell off the federal land, including some pristine forest land, to private folks. Maybe we'll sell it to Japan, or maybe we'll sell it to Germany, or maybe we'll sell it to Bin Laden. Who knows? I mean, you know, Salman Bin Laden, Osama's half-brother, bailed out George W. Bush's oil company when it was failing. I mean, the Bin Laden family's got a lot of money. Maybe they'd like to buy it. And then you can use that money for the next 5 years to fund your schools. And then at the end of 5 years, we'll be out of office and you won't have any forests left and your schools will be back in the same problem you had when you started. Isn't conservative logic wonderful? Isn't it just brilliant? By the way, time for a Dean alert.
California and Texas and New York. And we go to South Dakota and Oregon and Washington and Michigan. And then we're going to Washington, D.C. to take back the White House.
Hey, good on Howard Dean. This weekend, he said, the first course of action I would recommend, he's talking about the revelation that Dick Cheney, was apparently the guy who told Scooter Libby, according to Fitzgerald, according to the prosecutor, the federal prosecutor, Dick Cheney was the guy who told Scooter Libby to release classified information, to leak classified information. And according to George, he didn't even know anything about it, you know.
And I don't know if we're going to find out the senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration. And there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
But apparently it was Dick Cheney. And so Howard Dean comes out and on TV this weekend on CBS's Face the Nation program with Bob Schieffer and says the first course of action that I would recommend is that if we find out if this is true or not. In other words, did Cheney actually authorize or ask Scooter Libby to release classified information? If he did, then Dean says, if it is true, then the vice president has to step aside. Later on in the conversation, Dean said, if that happened at a time of war, the vice president cannot sit in the office he now occupies. And, in fact, according to the Associated Press, that's exactly what happened. The headline, Libby authorized by White House superiors to leak classified data. Vice President Cheney's former chief of staff, I. Lewis Scooter Libby, told a grand jury that his superiors authorized him to give secret information to reporters as part of a Bush administration defense of intelligence used to justify invading Iraq, according to court papers. Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald said in documents filed last month that he plans to introduce evidence that Libby, quote, disclosed to reporters the contents of a classified national intelligence estimate in the summer of 2003, end quote. So, looks like that's the case. Looks like that's the case. So, here we have, and here's the irony. We have Dick Cheney being accused of two major crimes this weekend. Over the course of the last week, let's say, two major crimes. One, you've got this fellow Paul Pillar or Pillar. I've heard it pronounced several different ways. Paul Pillar, let's say, of the CIA. He was formerly the head of the Near East division of the CIA. You know, he was responsible for all the intelligence coming out of Iraq and Iran from 2000 to 2005, and he has now come out and said that the CIA told the Bush administration, "There's no reason to go in. There's no reason to take out Saddam." Now, up until this point, we've all been operating on the assumption that the CIA had said that it was a slam dunk. Remember? Where did that information come from? Oh yeah, Bob Woodward. Bob Woodward, in his book, he said that Tenet said to Bush, when Bush said, you know, are we really sure that this guy has weapons of mass destruction? The Tenet said it's a slam dunk. A story apparently told to Bob Woodward by George W. Bush. Interesting. So, on the one hand, we've got now Dick Cheney and apparently George W. Bush as well lying to the American people about what the CIA was saying, that the CIA was actually saying there's no there there. And then at the same time, you've got Dick Cheney now apparently charged, according to this, with telling Scooter Libby to release classified information in violation of the law. And so, but what's going to be the headlines? What's everybody going to be talking about? Dick Cheney shooting this guy in the face. The guy, by the way, who essentially bailed out George W. Bush in 1999 from the Funeralgate scandal that threatened to sink his governorship of Texas. It gets all very, very strange. And you have to ask the question, you know, here's Dick Cheney. He's got two drunken driving arrests. He's been known to have a few. And it's illegal in Texas to shoot after dark, and it's right around dark. And, well, is it a few beers? Was it that it was dark? I mean, what's the deal? You don't just turn around and shoot somebody. I mean, there's a million hunters in Texas. And last year there were only 19 accidents involving firearms. Something weird is going on here. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Something stinks with this whole Cheney shot this guy story. I got to say, just as I said, I think on the one hand that we focus on it at the risk of not focusing on the fact that Cheney has been charged in the last week with two what may well be felonies, certainly may be impeachable offenses. But at the same time, there's something really weird about this. I mean, the entire Cheney story. First of all, the guy that he shot apparently had just shot something himself. Now, I've never been quail hunting, but I've seen it done in the movies. And several folks in the chat room apparently have been. They've been talking about it. And I apparently, you shoot a gun near a bunch of quail, and they take off. They go flying away. So this guy shoots something, and then he's going to get his dead bird, and then Cheney shoots something. There's still some birds sitting around. That's number one. Number two, these guys are driving from place to place to shoot things. I mean, how sleazy is that? And in fact, the Independent in the UK notes, and this is not the first time Mr. Cheney has been on a controversial hunt. He once shot 70 farmed ringnet pheasants in a single session at the Rolling Rock Club in Pennsylvania in 2003, critics called it a canned hunt. He shot 70 birds? the phrase fish in a barrel comes to mind. I'd say it's not even the second time Mr. Cheney has been on a controversial hunt. I remember when he went hunting with Antonin Scalia, when Scalia was had before him on the Supreme Court to decide whether or not Cheney's records as head of the Energy Task Force got to be kept secret from we the people. But over at direland.typepad.com, a blog, smart Midwestern friend who has a lot of quail hunting experience writes, the entire Cheney thing accident story stinks. The delay in announcing it's suspicious, obviously. I'll bet Cheney had a few beers in him, and I'm not sure this is illegal in Texas. Drinking and hunting is illegal in most states, but couldn't find out about Texas. A few other notes worth reporting. Number one, the news reports say the accident happened around 5:30 p.m. on Saturday, and Texas quail can be hunted until 30 minutes after sunset. Sunset was at 6:18, which means they were legal until 6:48, the around 5:30 p.m. Suspicious. Two, news reports say that after Whittington had gotten off his shot and went looking for his bird, Cheney and the other hunter went to another spot where they saw a covey of quail. Texas quail might be different from Iowa quail, but here in Iowa, when a shotgun goes off, every quail within earshot flutters away. The story doesn't make sense. Three, none of the stories have commented on the fact that they were road hunting or hunting from a car. This is just about the lowest kind of low-rent, dishonorable kind of hunting there is. The phrase road hunting is often used synonymously with poaching. He says, when I was growing up in Iowa, I went pheasant or quail hunting on scores of occasions with my dad and others. We never would have hunted from a vehicle. It's an insult to even suggest that someone might. It's considered dangerous and déclassé, and it's too great an advantage for the hunter to be fair. In most states, including Texas, it's awful, also illegal. Four, hunting quail in Texas requires an upland game bird stamp, which costs $7. This is a relatively new requirement. I'll bet Cheney didn't have one. And five, the spin that Whittington came up from behind the vice president, implying that he snuck up on him or is somehow responsible because Cheney didn't know he was there. When hunting, it's bad form to walk in front of someone's gun. When given a choice, one would always approach another hunter from behind. But, you know, they had a whole day to decide how to spin this, and the spin was not Cheney's fault. Nothing wrong with Cheney. Somebody should be asking, you know, was this guy drinking? Was it after sunset? Why would he shoot 70 pheasant in one day? Editor and publisher, you know, the very stodgy, staid magazine of the publishing industry. Editor and publisher. Article by Greg Mitchell. More questions raised about delay in reporting Cheney misfire. The more than 18-hour delay in news emerging that the vice president of the United States had shot a man, sending him to the intensive care unit with his wounds, grew even more curious late Sunday. ENP has learned that the official confirmation of the shooting came only after a local reporter from Corpus Christi, Texas, received a tip from the owner of the property. Well, wait a minute. When somebody's shot and they're treated in a hospital, the hospital is required to make a police report. You have to report gunshot wounds. Apparently, unless you've been shot by the vice president. By the way, the last time a vice president of the United States shot somebody, if my recollection is correct, it was Aaron Burr. He shot Alexander Hamilton, who several days later died. A rather painful death. He notes, the editor and publisher notes, hunting accidents are exceedingly rare in Texas. In 2004, the state's 1 million-plus hunters were involved in only 29 hunting-related accidents, only 19 of them involving firearms. The Chicago Tribune notes, when the vice president of the U.S. shoots a man under any circumstance, that is extremely relevant information. Why wasn't it made public immediately? The vice president is well known for preferring to operate in secret. But when the vice president's office or the White House delays in reporting a shooting like Saturday's to the public via the media, it needlessly raises suspicions and questions of trust. And it may just further the impression held by many, rightly or wrongly, that the White House doesn't place the highest premium on keeping the public fully and publicly informed. And finally, let's keep in mind that Whittington was the guy who was brought in by George W. Bush to head the funeral commission, if my information is correct. This from a story from the Austin Chronicle in 1999. Starts out, on April 15, 1998, funeral magnate Robert Waltrip talked with the Governor George W. Bush in the Texas Capitol. That much is not in dispute. However, the content of their discussion is the subject of considerable dispute. and the action taken by the governor's staff members, a half dozen legislators, and Texas Attorney General John Cornyn after the April 15 meeting are part of what may be the biggest influencing buying scandal in recent memory. This is referred to as the Funeral Gate story. It started out with a lawsuit, and that lawsuit turned into kind of a whistleblowing thing. The article continues, clearly the Politico with the most to lose in Funeral Gate is George W. Bush. And they go through the whole thing. I mean, all the detail is here. And fired TFSC Director Eliza May has filed a whistleblower lawsuit against the state. But she was replaced by Mr. Whittington, as far as I can tell. So the guy who saved Bush's butt politically in 1999 gets shot by the vice president, and it's too much. It's too weird. Anyway, 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Rich in Minneapolis. Hey, Rich.
Hello.
Hey, you're on the air.
Okay, I just want to make a quick comment about the quail hunting, but first let me say that I think that this is one of the most crooked administrations we've ever had running the country. But
yeah.
With quail hunting, I used to do a lot of that in my younger days, and there are times that when a covey jumps up, there will be a couple of stragglers that will just stay down in the grass, and
you
practically have to step on them.
Okay, so it's not quite so suspicious that
I wouldn't go that far, but I just wanted to clarify that point about the quail.
Okay, cool. Thanks a lot, Rich.
I'm sure there's suspicious things. All right, thank you.
Appreciate it. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Rick.
Yeah, sorry, Tom.
Good. What's up?
Well, this is, you know, at first glance, the thing about Cheney was a bit shocking. I don't think there's any conspiracy here. Of course, you brought up the fact that it kind of ties into the secrecy mode of this administration. You said a Corpus Christi reporter actually reported this.
Yeah, a reporter who apparently was friends with the woman who owned the farm where these guys were hunting.
So theoretically, of course, if that hadn't happened, the administration might not have let us know about this at all.
Right, we never would have known about it. I mean, here's this guy, and he was attended to. And the other thing that's very odd is the vice president, wherever he goes, they carry an ambulance with him.
They have.
Okay? Yeah. And so he's got an ambulance there. He's got an ambulance staff. And this guy is treated at the site by an MD, by a physician, by the vice president's physician. And then he's transported to a local hospital. And his wounds are sufficiently bad that he's then taken from the local hospital to the big city hospital. But they're spinning it in the media like this guy just had a little buckshot picked out of him with some tweezers, and they put some methylate on it, you know. And I don't think you stay in the ICU for 2 days because you just got a little bit of buckshot in you.
No, and I don't know too much about hunting quail or anything else because I'm not a hunter, but there were some other stories that kind of were touched on over the weekend. The fact that Libby now claimed in sworn testimony that Cheney had authorized him to leak classified information.
Yeah.
There's this fellow that you pronounced his name two different ways, Pillar.
Yeah.
CIA man who said that the CIA did not, in fact, say it was a slam dunk, that there were weapons of mass destruction.
Well, in fact, the CIA said, we've got him in a box. No, don't kick over this beehive. Yeah, it's a very, very strange one. Rick, thanks for the call. Philip in Palm Harbor, Florida. We have about a half a minute, Philip. You wanted to comment about Pat Roberts taking memory pills?
Yeah.
Saw that on Meet the Press.
You saw that.
My mind.
There's only one memory pill approved by FDA, and it's called Aricept. And it's for people who are in the first stage of Alzheimer's.
Right. Yeah, I was wondering, is Pat Roberts, was that a gag that
no,
didn't go over? Or was
I don't
Pat
think
Roberts
so.
Actually
he showed
sitting
you the
there?
Pills, didn't he?
Yeah, but, you know, so Pat Roberts is taking a prescription for Alzheimer's?
Apparently, first stage, it's the only one FDA approved.
I know. I'm familiar with it. My mother, I'm familiar with it.
He's in his late 70s.
Yeah.
When is it, you know, if he were working for IBM, they would have retired him years ago.
Yeah. Interesting. See, I thought he was just making a bad joke and that it was a bottle of vitamins or something, but everybody looked at him shocked, and now it's starting to make sense. Philip, thanks a lot for that tip. That's very interesting. 45 minutes past the hour is the Tom Hartman radio program, the radio support group up by and for We the People of the United States of America. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. 10 minutes before the hour, the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where reason is our lifestyle choice. Yeah, no, this guy is still in the ICU, apparently, after 3 days. And so, you know, why was the story released? Why was it delayed, rather? Why, in fact, had this reporter not gotten an inside tip? Would it possibly we have never have known about it? I suspect it's because the guy took a bigger shot than we're being told. His family is now saying, you know, out of respect for his good friend Dick Cheney, he's not going to say anything to the press. I suspect it's he doesn't want Dick Cheney to finish off the job. I'm joking. And, you know, as folks in the chat room have pointed out, and as one of our callers pointed out, this is the sort of thing that can happen when you go quail hunting. On the other hand, shouldn't we know? When the Vice President of the United States shoots somebody, I mean, shouldn't the American public know about that? Dave in Chicago. Hey, Dave.
Hey, I like to really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I listen to you. I listen to both sides now. I listen to the Democratic side and I listen to the Republican side. That's the reason why I like listening to political shows. But I would like to thank you for not humiliating and downgrading the Vice President like some of your other callers did when it was simply just an accident. I mean, it was friends out there.
In all probability, you're right. Keep in mind, this is a guy who's got a couple of drunk driving arrests and convictions. And there's been a lot of talk in Washington over the years about how much he drinks. And
right.
You wonder if this is an accident that didn't need to happen. Okay. But, and maybe that accounts for why it took 24 hours to report it, why it was never reported to the police, because then there would have been a routine breathalyzer.
Right.
I don't know.
The reason why I think is because what would that do? That would like humiliate the.
It would be a political disaster. It would be a political disaster. Yeah, and that's my point. I mean, why would they take 24 hours to report it? Dave, good question you raised. Thanks a lot for the call, Jake in Arcata, California. Hey, Jake.
Hey, Tom. You know, just like you said, we probably never would have even heard of this if it wasn't for the tip to the Corpus Christi reporter. Okay, and the whole point is. Why did Dick Cheney shoot this guy in the face? The previous caller said it was an accident. You're saying it's an accident. I think it probably was an accident. But like you said, if he was drunk at the time, I'm sorry, he's negligent. And that alone shows what type of man Dick Cheney is. He was negligent.
We don't know that he was drunk. All we know is that they didn't notify anybody for 24 hours.
Well, like you said.
That they didn't know anybody. They didn't notify anybody, period.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. They didn't notify anybody.
They were in major cover-up mode. And
yeah, exactly.
And this involved two different hospitals. It had to have involved, you know, 30, 40 people at the very least. And obviously all of them were told to keep your mouths shut because can you imagine being an ER nurse and the vice president and a guy comes in that the vice president just shot? I mean, you're going to call all your friends and say you're not going to believe what just happened. That's going to hit the news in an instant. They must have intimidated these people in these hospitals to keep their mouths shut.
You're right. And the whole point is why. And like you say, this raises suspicions of a serious nature that we need answers to. And Cheney should have to answer what really happened.
Yeah, good. Well said. Skip in Olympia, Washington. Hey, Skip, what's up?
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
Good.
I want to thank you for supporting organic food because that helps everybody along. Good food makes good minds, good bodies.
There you go.
And I like that you're an advocate for that. I also appreciate your advocacy for the knowledge of history.
Okay.
I just wanted to say real quick, Channel 5 news here out of Seattle last night was talking about this Cheney story. And the very last thing they said is that Cheney is known as being tough on defense and really not known to leak. So they actually, at the end, defined him as a non-leaker.
Wait a minute. The guy who was just Patrick Fitzgerald just said was responsible for all the national security leaks?
Yes.
That's incredible.
Dick Cheney himself was.
This is your local station that said this?
That was the very last part of the sentence on King 5 News last night.
That's incredible. Well, I hope you called King 5 News and told them that they shouldn't be doing Dick Cheney's spinning for him. I mean, that's outrageous. Nick in Pueblo, Colorado. Hey, Nick, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, I was just thinking, every time you read in the papers where there's a hit-and-run driver involved in an accident where there's drugs, alcohol, what happens? He drives away. 24 hours later, he turns himself in.
Right, because he wants to sober up.
There you go. So, I don't know if Cheney's a drunk. He acts like he's one, but very suspicious.
Well, he does have to. He's the first vice president in the history of the United States to come into office with two criminal convictions. And George W. Bush is the first president of the United States to come into office with one criminal conviction, and all three of them were convictions for drunk driving.
Oh, beautiful.
So, yeah, yeah. So, you know, take it where you want. Billy in Santa Cruz. Hey, Billy, what's on your mind today?
Hey, buddy. Well, a couple of things. First of all, you know, what a pig. He killed 70 birds?
In one day, yeah. Some reports are 95. This is the folks in the chat room are making the comment. One of the folks in the chat room made the comment that there's a difference between a sportsman and a killer. And the people who enjoy killing just go out and kill as much as they can. And people who are sportsmen like the prey to have a chance, you know. And anybody who would kill 70 birds in one afternoon, you know, is not a sportsman. He's somebody who enjoys killing.
Here's what I want to say about these things. I'll go back to that. You know, when Scalia was out with him, I guess it was a good thing he agreed to vote the way he did when they were out there.
There you go.
And here's the other thing.
Yes.
So he was out quail hunting? I had no idea that...
Dan Quayle is still around, right?
I had no idea sitting VPs could hunt former VPs.
There you go. Okay, Billy. And finally, thank you very much. And finally, Andy Borowitz. Vice President Dick Cheney revealed today that he shot a fellow hunter while on a quail hunting trip over the weekend because he believed the man was fugitive terror mastermind Ayman al-Zawahiri. Mr. Cheney acknowledged that the man he sprayed with pellets on Saturday was not al-Zawahiri, but rather Harry Whittington, a 78-year-old multimillionaire lawyer from Austin, blaming the mix-up on, as Cheney said, faulty intelligence. Said Cheney, I believed I had credible intelligence that al-Zawahiri had infiltrated my hunting party in disguise with the intent of spraying me with pellets. Only after I shot Harry in the face and he shouted, Cheney, you bastard, that I realized that his intelligence was faulty. End of quote. Yeah, thanks a lot. Andy Borowitz, BorowitzReport.com. Tongue-in-cheek. It's an interesting story. I think there's other, far more important things happening in the world, though, particularly what's going on economically right now between the United States and Iran, or the United States and Japan, and the possibility now, two different nations' newspapers reporting that a date has been set in March for a U.S. attack on nuclear facilities in Iran. We'll get into that and other information as we continue with the program. It's 57 minutes past the hour.
You have been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Alex, if you can hear me, I just lost all music in the background. There we go. Thank you. Welcome back. It's 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The social conservatives who resist the advances and freedoms of the baby boom era are like Luddites who terrorized England. So says Leonard Steinhorn. Leonard is the author of The Greater Generation, in defense of the baby boom legacy. Hey, Leonard, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
You know, it's interesting. In Adam Curtis's documentary for the BBC, he points out that the Muslim Brotherhood, which morphed into Al-Qaeda, and the founder of this organization, who was al-Zawahiri's mentor, who then became the mentor of bin Laden, was founded in grew out of this guy living in St. Louis in the United States in the 1960s, about the same time that Leo Strauss was teaching at the University of Chicago. Both of them were looking at the teenagers of the baby boom generation and saying, oh, my God, the world is going to hell in a handbasket. We've got to do something about it. And both of them came up with authoritarian responses. Mm-hmm. In the case of Leo Strauss, it was the neocon movement. In the case of the fellow who became the founder of the Muslim Brotherhood, it became Al-Qaeda. You suggest that, in fact, this wasn't social chaos.
Well, I mean, heaven forbid that we celebrate women's rights and civil rights and diversity and environmental protection and gay rights and personal freedoms. I mean, society is coming to an end, isn't it?
Well, that's what the conservatives would have you think.
Right, exactly. You see, and here's the funny thing. You know, the conservatives are really, really loud right now, but we can't mistake them being loud for being popular. You see, the media reward outrage. And these folks are angry that the world has passed them by. They're like the prohibitionists. If the press was looking at the prohibitionists in 1921, they would have said, wave of the future. This is America. This is mainstream America.
But well, for a while it was.
Well, but it was a wave of the past. It was a wave of the past. So what happened is that reflex whipping action of the past imposed its will on us for a number of years. It's like the Luddites, as I wrote in the book,
yeah.
The Luddites in Brooklyn, in Britain. They were angry at industrialism. They started smashing machines. Everyone thought that that was the wave of the future, and it wasn't. The bottom line is that there's a real sort of new silent majority in this country of people who are tolerant, inclusive, open-minded, believe in full equality among the races and ethnicities, women and men, and they're not getting their voices heard.
Why not?
Well, as I say, the media reward outrage. You know, when you look at that 2004 poll, if you want to call it that, that said that moral values was the top issue, only 20% of Americans put that down. And that certainly didn't mean that it was sort of the religious right's moral values. That means 80% didn't. But let's also remember that that most Americans are pretty content with the more free, equal, inclusive, and tolerant society we live in, so we don't think the clock's going to be turned back. Only those people who are angry, they're the ones who vote as a bloc and who vote on those cultural issues. So we're sort of looking at it in sort of this Alice in Wonderland through the looking glass perspective in American politics, whereas these folks are really the minority and they're trying to impose their views on us, and the media is, I would say, sort of a willing stooge in the process.
We're talking with Leonard Steinhorn, the author of The Greater Generation, in defense of the baby boom legacy. Leonard, Tom Brokaw popularized my parents' generation, probably your parents' generation, the mm-hmm. generation who fought World War II, basically, as the greatest generation. And, you know, that they quietly built this country and put things together. And there really is a certain nobility to that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to acknowledge that.
I do. I mean, I acknowledge what they did. I acknowledge their fight against fascism, the sacrifices they made during the Depression. My whole point is that when two generations face the same problems, the same hypocrisies, the same lack of freedom across the board in our country that existed at the end of the 50s and beginning of the 60s, one largely chose to stick with the status quo, the other tried to challenge the status quo. It doesn't mean that all members of the greatest generation were bigots. What it does mean is that the critical mass were accepting of the society that, whereas a critical mass of boomers said the society as it was unacceptable. I mean, when you think about what life was like for black people at that time, I mean, in my book, I begin my book talking about how black Americans would put a combination of potato, eggs, and lye on their hair, on their head, which would burn fiery sores into their scalp just so they could straighten their hair and seem less black. Or they would put skin bleach that would burn their skin, and the name of these skin bleachers are called Black No More. We were denying the dignity of people. We did it with women. We had separate classifieds for women and men, and it wasn't unusual for classified calling for a woman to be a stenographer or a secretary to ask for a girl attractive 5'5 to 5'7 in heels.
Yeah, I remember back in the 70s, you know, running Help Wanted ads, and you had to choose whether it was in the Help Wanted Men or Help Women Wanted Women section.
Right.
I mean, that was in the 1970s.
And they weren't separate but equal. They were very unequal in terms of the type
sure.
of jobs that were being offered. I mean, if you happen to be lucky enough as a woman to go to law school, at Harvard Law, you're one of the 15 women who goes to Harvard Law in those years, you would be grilled by the dean as to why you were taking the place of a man. Or if you do become a lawyer and you go into the courtroom, these older judges would refer to you as like lawyerette or attorney generalette.
Right.
And the laws even prohibited women from getting their own credit, getting mortgages.
Leonard Steinholm, the author of The Greater Generation in Defense of the Baby Boom Legacy. Leonard, the attack on the baby boom generation that is being made by conservatives by and large, including, ironically, baby boomers like George W. Bush, is that the baby boom generation is the selfish generation, that it's the generation that has spent itself into debt, that this nation is facing the greatest debt that we've ever seen, that it is the generation that dwells, that lives for the moment and lives for joy, that wants to, you know, have free sex and smoke pot and, you know, all these kinds of things, and that it's all about me, me, me.
Well, you know, it's interesting because there's certainly plenty of materialism in the baby boom generation, but there also was in the greatest generation. If you dial the history back a bit, they were called the generation that only wanted to keep up with the Joneses.
Right.
And then you dial history back a little bit more, and they were talking about conspicuous consumption. So America's always been sort of a materialistic culture, and success in this culture has been defined by how well you do materially. So I don't think we can sort of just sort of throw that all onto boomers. But what I do think is going on is the following. Boomers represent social change. Boomers have fundamentally changed the culture of this country in so many ways. And so those who criticize boomers are really sort of using boomers as a proxy in the culture war. Because if you can say that everything boomers started in the 1960s, it was just an adolescent rebellion or sort of this sort of selfish narcissism or sort of a non-serious thing, then you can sort of say that if it's a non-serious generation, then everything they did was non-serious. Let's go back to the good old days of the 1950s where everyone knew their place and certain people weren't so uppity.
Yeah. And in fact, I would, in answer to my own question, I would suggest that the people who have spent us into such debt were Ronald Reagan, who was not a member of the boomer generation, began this whole thing, and Bush, who is reactive against our generation, is continuing it.
Oh, exactly.
It's basically the conservatives.
Yeah, Bush is a funny example because he basically has gone out and said he sort of dislikes his own generation. But it's funny because...
Although he was all in favor of it when he was drinking in college.
Well, of course. But also the other interesting thing about Bush is that when he ran for president in 2000 and 2004, did you see the religious right folks on the podium during prime time at his conventions?
Sure.
No, they weren't there. They were hidden in a back room with no media access. The ones you saw were African Americans and women,
right,
or Rudy Giuliani, who's pro-choice and pro-gay rights.
You're right.
They knew that to get elected, they had to at least sort of give lip service, if not more, to these sort of boomer inclusive values. Okay.
Yeah.
And then they get elected and they do this stuff behind the scenes.
Yeah, fascinating. The book. Are you familiar with Strauss and Howe's The Fourth Turning and their multi-generational work? Do you see this generation as being identical to five generations ago?
Well,
what would have been the progressive generation of the late 1890s, the early 1910, 1920?
I think there are fundamental similarities. I think the funny thing is, though, is that the boomer generation really did sort of break that old Victorian culture that was around five generations ago.
Yeah.
Sort of all those Victorian restraints. What I also find really interesting is that those younger than boomers are very similar to boomers. We can parse all of these Generation X's and Y's as we want, but when you look at the attitudes and the values, they're very similar to boomers. I call them boomers without the 60s. And in fact, younger people today tend to be more socially liberal than even the more socially liberal boomers.
Yeah, well, I would say these are simply the values on which this nation was founded. I mean, they're the values of the Enlightenment. You can trace this back to Rousseau and Locke in the 1600s.
Absolutely, and boomers are part of that march to actualize those values.
There you go. Well said. Leonard Steinholm, the article, or the book, rather, The Greater Generation, in defense of the baby boom legacy. Leonard, thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
It's 16 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program, the place where being progressive never felt so good. Speaking of boomer generation values, we'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
High and low, all must go, hark to the shout of war. Leave to the women the harvest yield. Gird ye men for the sinister field, a saber instead of a scythe to yield. War, red war.
And welcome back, my friends, to the Tom Hartman Radio Program. 21 minutes past the hour, the place where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. Victoria Jones on the line with us in the Talk Radio News Service. Well, Victoria, we discover that one of the guys with his finger on the nuclear trigger, when he actually pulls the trigger, very often accidentally has bullets ripping through the bodies of his friends.
Right, and we're being told so many things now that are starting to come out. The first one is that, of course, we didn't hear about this for 24 hours.
Now, was that so Cheney would have time to sober up? I'm serious. This is a guy who's. This is the first vice president in the history of the United States to come into office with two criminal convictions, and they were both alcohol-related.
Well, what is also interesting is that the local police were not allowed to question the vice president by the Secret Service. Now, the local police are not happy about this. Some people are saying, well, it's just grandstanding. The Secret Service know what's best. But if Dick Cheney wanted to show everybody that he was just one of the people, just folks like us, you'd think he'd want to be questioned by the local police.
Yeah, and again, you have to ask the question, was there a 24-hour delay so he could sober up?
Well, that is an interesting question. Now, then the other reason that we're being told by Scott McClellan at the White House is that, don't laugh like a drain when I say this. While the White House believes that it is very important, as always, to get all the information out to the public, pause for laughter,
yes.
Nevertheless, their priority was making sure that the shot guy was okay, to which my question would be, and probably will be tomorrow, is it not possible to walk and chew gum at the same time? Presumably the people who would be speaking to the press are not the same people who would be applying the tourniquets and stopping the bleeding.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. There's something fishy here.
Yeah, there's something slightly off here. And it's also interesting to me how Catherine Armstrong, I believe her name is, who owns this ranch, was at great pains to point out how the vice president was in no way, shape, or form to blame that this man actually did the virtual equivalent of jumping up and down in front of the gun with a big sign on him saying, shoot me.
Right, right. And, I think that somebody needs to be asking Scotty McClellan, hint, hint, Victoria, was the president sober at the time of the shooting? And if he was, why did he refuse to talk to the local police department? Because this, after all, was a shooting in their jurisdiction. Does he not respect the law?
Well, I will try to find a polite way of asking that that won't get me completely banned, Tom.
Well, wasn't that polite, what I just said?
I think I would ask something a little bit more generic about, shooting parties. Very often there's drinking involved, you know. Has the vice president and his companions had a drink or two?
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's a nice way to say it. But just, get the meme out there. It's an interesting one. So that said, what else is happening in Washington, D.C. today? What's going on in the real world?
Well, in the Senate Homeland Security, a couple of interesting hearings. One is in the House on mining safety, which basically the experts are saying there isn't much. But also in the Senate, the Senate Homeland Security Committee is having another Katrina hearing, and this is one where we're hearing about fraud and corruption. And basically, it's really quite disastrous. And also, Michael Chertoff, Secretary of Homeland Security, spoke this morning and seems to be offing the blame again to Michael Brown and FEMA. And there certainly seems to be enough blame that they could happily share it, quite honestly, but he is determined not to take the fall. But it does seem as though there is a certain amount of fraud and corruption going on in the rebuilding, or whatever they're calling it now, of New Orleans. And the House committee, the Republican House committee that's been investigating Katrina, that's separate from the Senate where it's bipartisan, the report that they're due to issue on Wednesday is so scathing of the White House, of government at all levels, but there's no way that the White House can get around this by saying it was all levels of government, of the president, and in particular how ill-served he was by his advisors. They actually use a phrase like, 4 years after September the 11th, we're still not ready for prime time. And they make the point that this is how we did when we had notice of a disaster.
Now, why would the Republican members of the House be doing this, be attacking the president, unless it had something to do with the fact that every single one of them is up for re-election in 10 months?
Well, I think I actually have to say, Tom, I think it's a combination of two things. I mean, for example, you've got Representative Christopher Shays, and I've attended some of the hearings, and he was tough, and he was generally ticked off and angry. Representative Tom Davis, who's a local guy from one of the Virginia suburbs, who's pretty good about looking after the people in his district, he was genuinely ticked off. And so I think it's a combination of, yes, everybody's up for re-election, but there is also a level of astonishment and disgust at the incompetence that I think gives them freedom to genuinely separate themselves from the White House and to go, look, they did that. That's not us. That's them. We don't want to get tarred with this brush.
But right. That brings it back to the electoral politics dimension of it.
Right. I think it's a combination of the two, but I have to say, I do, and I've noticed this with Senator Susan Collins as well as Senator Lieberman, there is some real genuine outrage and disgust, even among politicians.
Even among Republicans and conservatives about what's going on with the Bushes.
I swear.
I believe you. I believe you. Okay, and I hope you get an opportunity to ask, how drunk was Dick Cheney when he shot his friend in the face, bullets ripping through the guy's body and flesh. Thanks, Victoria Jones. 27 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Monty, this seems strange to me. The movies had that movie thing. But nonsense has a welcome ring. And heroes don't come easy.
Welcome to the pill that will help you escape the matrix. The Tom Hartman radio program. Japan earned more from investments abroad than from trade last year for the first time in its post-war history. Now, consider this just for a moment, my friends. This is from the Financial Times. This is a big deal. There is stuff happening on the international economic horizon that is a huge, that is going to affect, that is affecting right now all of our lives and is going to affect our lives in massive ways. And we have to understand it. We must get a handle on this. We have to do something about this. And a lot of it's going to require political action, political activity to solve these problems. But first, we have to understand what the problem is. Consider this. Just here's a juxtaposition of stories. The first from the Financial Times today. Japan earned more from investments abroad than from trade last year for the first time in its post-war history, reflecting earnings on massive overseas bonds holdings. In other words, the country of Japan's earnings were greater from interest payments on the debt that they hold than from all the stuff they sold us. All that Sony stuff, all half the stuff in your house that was made in Japan, particularly all the electronics, and all the Japanese auto car, automobiles in the United States, all of that stuff, all the profit on that did not generate as much money for Japan as the interest on the debt that they hold. And what is most of the debt that they hold? Well, to quote the Financial Times, overseas income includes that from Japanese investments in foreign securities, largely U.S. government bonds. Now, does this mean that Japan is not exporting as much? Does this mean that Japanese industry has taken a hit? No. In fact, Japan's exports rose last year by 7.4% to a record 62 billion yen. That's $530 billion. So their sales are up. Their profits are up. But they are making more money on their debt, on our debt that they are holding. This is not good. It's not good for us. This is very good for Japan. In fact, as Peter Morgan, an economist at HSBC, says, it's on autopilot to the extent that it's a function of the net accumulated asset position. He said it is self-perpetuating. He said, as a result, even if the trade balance turned negative, you would still see all this income coming in. See, it's like this. Countries are sort of like families, and if you're making your living, let's say you're making furniture and selling it for a living, you've got income from this furniture that you're selling. Well, if you stop making the furniture, you don't have any more income anymore. On the other hand, if you inherited $1 million or $10 million, and you loaned it to the federal government at a 4.5%, 5% interest rate, in other words, you bought treasury bills, then you have a check coming back. You have 5%. It's $10 million. You're getting $50,000, $500,000? Yeah, you're getting $500,000 a year, every year, in interest, no matter what you do. You could be out partying. You could be living in Thailand. You could be sitting on the deck. You don't have to be making any furniture anymore. Japan has now gone from being a country that is making most of their money making stuff to being a country that is making most of their money by owning the debt of other nations. And we're the primary nation whose debt they hold. We used to be a country that made money holding the debt of other nations. When Ronald Reagan came into office, we were the largest creditor nation in the world. That is to say, more countries owed us money and paid interest payments to us than any other country in the world. And that made us economically strong, along with the fact that we were the world's largest exporter of finished goods. We manufactured goods for the entire planet when Ronald Reagan came into office. And 25 years now of conservative economic policies and insane trade policies with most favored nation status for China and other nations like them, the Bill Clinton signing and pushing through the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trades, GATT, NAFTA, and now CAFTA, the World Trade Organization, all these multilateral, bilateral treaties, these trade treaties, the elimination of U.S. tariffs, and most importantly, 25 years of trickle-down economics, running the federal government into debt and borrowing from the Japanese and the Chinese so that these conservative politicians can make it look like our economy is still functioning, has brought us to what I think is just an absolute edge. In today's Wall Street Journal, Asia's foreign exchange holdings jumped in January, signaling that reserves in the region are again set to balloon in 2006 and that the global financial imbalances continue to grow. Reserves in Asia jumped by almost $30 billion in January from a month earlier to more than $2.7 trillion. The flow of Asian reserves into the treasury market effectively means the region continues to finance the large U.S. budget deficit. But analysts say this imbalance, now this is not an editorial in the Wall Street Journal, this is a news story, but analysts say this imbalance is not sustainable in the long term. What's going to happen in the long term? Well, eventually they're going to say, you know, the debt is coming due. In fact, they're already saying it. Here we have, for example, the White House wants to sell federal forest land. Why? Because they don't want to tax millionaires and billionaires. They got this whole hysterical anti-tax thing. So let's sell off the country. The Bush administration is proposing to sell 307,000 acres of national forest land in 32 states to developers to subsidize schools in timber country. The U.S. Forest Service hopes to generate $800 million over 5 years. As Senator Jeff Bingaman, the Democrat from New Mexico, said, this is short-sighted, ill-advised, and an irresponsible shift in federal land management policy that would hurt hunters, anglers, campers, foresters, cattlemen, miners, and other users of public land. Well, I'd go on to say that it's the selling off of America. Now, to whom are we selling America? Well, here's a story from the Seattle Times. A company in the United Arab Emirates is poised to take over significant operations at six U.S. ports as part of a corporate sale. Well, of course, we're giving them all our money in exchange for all that oil. What are they going to use that money for? They've got to buy stuff here. Leaving a country, writes the Associated Press, Ted Bitt, brightest of the Associated Press, the Seattle Times, leaving a country with ties to the 9/11 hijackers with influence over a maritime industry considered vulnerable to terrorism. The $6.8 billion sale is expected to be approved on Monday. Do you get this? The UAE, a loose federation of seven emirates on the Saudi Peninsula, was an important operational and financial base for the hijackers who flew the jetliners into the World Trade Center. This is from the Associated Press. Critics of the proposed purchase said a port operator complicit in smuggling or terrorism could manipulate manifest, you know, yeah, so we're going to sell our ports to countries in the Middle East. Paul Krugman in his op-ed today, last year America spent 57% more than it earned in world markets. That is, our imports were 57% larger than our exports. Turns out we're as addicted to imported money as we are to imported oil. The Paul Craig Roberts, the former associate editor of the editorial page in the Wall Street Journal, the assistant secretary of the Treasury in the Reagan administration, notes, last year the Bureau of Labor Statistics re-benchmarked the payroll jobs data back to 2000. So let's look at what George W. Bush has brought us, my friends. Job growth, he writes, over the last 5 years is the weakest on record. 7 million jobs short of keeping up with population growth. Over the past 5 years, the U.S. economy experienced a net job loss in goods-producing activities. U.S. manufacturing lost 2.9 million jobs, almost 17% of the manufacturing workforce. The wipeout is across the board, right across the board. Communications equipment lost 43% of its workforce. These jobs still exist. They've just gone to other countries. 43% of its workforce. Semiconductors and electronic components lost 37% of its workforce. The workforce in computer and electronic products declined 30%. Electrical equipment and appliances lost 25% of its employees. The workforce in motor vehicles and parts declined 12%. Furniture and related products lost 17% of its jobs. Apparel manufacturers lost almost half of the workforce since George Bush came into office. Employment in textile mills declined 43%. Paper and paper products lost one-fifth of its job. The workforce in plastics and rubber products declined by 15%. Even manufacturers of beverage and tobacco products experienced a 7% shrinkage in jobs. Well, what about the knowledge jobs? They never appeared. The information sector lost 17% of its jobs. Telecommunications workforce declined 25%. Even accounting and bookkeeping shrank by 4%. Computer systems design and related jobs lost 9%. There are no jobs for graduates. This is the result of so-called free trade. This is the result of borrowing against our children's future so that we can make it look like it's the economy's okay right now, so that Reagan and Bush and Clinton and Bush, well, actually Clinton didn't do the borrowing part. We'll give him credit for that, although he did do the international trade part. And certainly George W. Bush, borrowing like drunken sailors so that they can spend money to make the economy look good so that they and their cronies can get reelected year after year after year. And of course it's not just the presidents that do it, because the president doesn't have the power to spend. It's Congress as well. And it's these conservative Congresses that have been coming along ever since Ronald Reagan came into power and this became fascism. You are seeing right now the result of the Gingrich Revolution. You want to see the Gingrich Revolution? Look around you at the empty factories. Look around you at the call tech support for Earthlink or for Dell. Call an airline and try and book a seat on a plane. You're going to be talking to somebody in some other country. And not just a pick on those companies. I mean, this is just right across the board. The top 20 industries, acquisitions. Now, this is from 1979 through 2005. Telecommunications, 201 companies in the United States acquired from companies outside the United States, $130 billion. Oil and gas, 408 acquisitions, $128 billion. Business services, 1,790 companies. We're talking massive corporations, $106 billion. 409 food and service products corporations, $88 billion. Sold, we are selling our country off. 46 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Walk that walk, talk that talk, walk that walk.
Exposing the con and conservative. Tom Hartman here with you. Talk radio for the rest of us. Our number 866-440-8466, 440-THOM, Paula in Eureka, California. Hey, Paula.
Tom, good morning.
Good morning.
Speaking of Paul Craig Roberts, the reason I was calling you this morning is just for anyone out there who is concerned about the domestic eavesdropping and, you know, who did get active and call about Alito, I was calling about this scheduled vote on the Patriot Act this week.
Yes, and you know, we can hope and pray that the Republicans in the Senate will filibuster this, but...
Yes, and... I really feel that this is just as, you know, what Victoria was saying, you know, speaking of a level of disgust, that this is a very McCarthy-esque and Orwellian piece of legislation that was rammed through when people were so frightened after 9/11. And Senator Feingold alone, you know, knows, I think he was the only one who actually read it besides you. And Paul Craig Roberts, when he came on your show the other day and was speaking about that specific section, which... called for the expansion, speaking of the Secret Service, of a national federal police force, and the verbiage surrounding that specific section, how vague and how, you know, the powers that are being given. And I just, I did call, you know, this morning to four senators, Senator Craig and John Sununu and Lisa Murkowski and Chuck Hagel, and also to Jane Harmon, who is the leading representative on the Intelligence Committee. And, you know, this is a week if you're concerned.
What did you learn when you called them, Paula?
I just said, you know, this is really not something that needs to be pushed through. And I did ask Senator Feingold's office if there was anything that we out here could do besides the calling and the writing that I've done against this.
Mm-hmm.
And they just basically said to keep it up and to encourage, you know, your senators and representatives this week to not allow this to be renewed.
Yeah, I'd be interested to know what, you know, Senators Feingold and Boxer have to say about it. They those being your senators, and my guess is your call to them would have more impact than your call out of state.
I've written to Specter, Feingold, Boxer, and Feinstein, and I guess Senator Feinstein is planning on voting for it. I'm very deeply disappointed, and I was just hoping that you could, you know, remind your listeners what Paul Craig Roberts had to say about it, because when you asked the question that you asked was, why? Why would any elected official want this thing to go forward? And that's what I said. I feel that this is, you know, as you've said,
well, I think there's a certain level of intimidation. I mean,
absolutely.
Last week there was the vote in the House for this, was it not?
Yes.
And it was right after they herded everybody down into the basement and had the nerve gas attack.
Warning. Exactly.
I mean, it's a repeat of the anthrax attack, except this time, you know, it was a false alarm, but they figured out that if they get these members of Congress scared enough, they don't even need to have a real alarm.
Exactly. And so for those people that are concerned about the eavesdropping, this to me is far, far more ominous. And I saw the initial bill was very scary, and this is the only chance we've got to keep
the toll-free number if you want to call a senator to filibuster this thing, because it's going to pass by a majority vote in both the House and the Senate. Because the Republicans are just solidly behind it. Mm-hmm. So the only way to stop it is with a filibuster. The number to call, and that can only happen in the Senate. So the number to call for your senators, and you should call them and suggest that they filibuster the Patriot Act, is 888-355-3588. 888-355-3588.
Thank you so much, Tom. Learned
Paula,
so much from you.
Paula, thank you so much for the call and for bringing up that issue.
Thank you.
Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin, welcome to the program.
Thank you. First, I'd like to discuss something. What is the idiot in the White House that's screwing this country up totally? What's his minimum wage now?
Which particular idiot are you referring to? There's several of them there.
W.
Oh, I don't know how much he's making. It's 200 and something.
Is it over $400,000 a year, his minimum wage, plus it gets full benefits?
You know, it may well be. I don't have any idea anymore.
But you were given the statistics on Japan rapidly accumulating all the prostitutes for sale in Washington and taking over this country economically.
Well, not just Japan. The point was that in today's Financial Times, they pointed out that Japan, just for the first time in its history, made more money last year on the interest that we gave them on the debt of ours that they have bought. In other words, in the interest that they gave us and the money that we borrowed from them, so, you know, that Reagan and Bush borrowed from them, than they did on manufactured goods. And they're kicking butt with manufactured goods.
Well, what better reason would it be to make a deal with the Japanese and hire them to be our managers and fire that bunch of...
There you go. Well, that's an idea, Armin. In fact, David Poole, our producer here, says that the presidential salary is $400,000 a year. I'm sure that actually we could probably find somebody in India to do it for maybe $500 a year. I don't know, maybe we're $5,000. Sharon in Tucson, Arizona. Hey, Sharon.
Hi. I just got through listening to you when you were talking about our debt.
Mm-hmm.
The average Joe don't even realize that exists.
I know. That's, and the average Joe is $100,000 in debt to all these countries, and it's scary. It should be scary to all of us. Sharon, we only have a few seconds left.
About
something else?
Yes, I basically called to ask you, when Cheney shot that guy, who's picking up the tab for that?
I would guess it's probably you and me.
I don't mind paying for him while he's at work, but it is fun if he do something stupid. Like those Bush girls when they ran and the Secret Service had to chase them, I think they should have to pay for that.
Yeah, well, you make a persuasive argument, Sharon, and thank you for the call and for making that point. Interesting. Yeah. No, I, at a certain level, I mean, we do have to provide for the security of our senior officers, our senior officials and their families, regardless of what they're doing. On the other hand, There's an off. What really chaps me is all the campaigning that Bush did on our nickel. That had not been done by any president before in the 2004 election. 57 minutes past the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Joan Claybrook, president of Public Citizen, and Vanessa Cerulli, the assistant editor of Common Dreams, commondreams.org, and Public Citizen, citizen.org, are going to be with us at the bottom of the hour. Bottom of this hour for our best of the rest of the news segment, looking at the news of the last week and of the upcoming week and of the moment. And in just a moment, Alec DeBro of the International Labor Communications Association is going to be with us. But first, it's time for a Berlusconi alert. Yes, indeed, you remember him, Silvio Berlusconi, the media mogul. Well, he started out as a small-time crook, small-time businessman. And a number of his friends now have gone to jail for their business associations with him. And he bought a TV station, and then he bought a radio station, and then he bought another radio station, and then he bought another TV station, then he bought a newspaper, then he bought another radio station, then he bought a radio network, and then he bought another newspaper, and then he bought a couple magazines, and then he bought a TV network, and then he bought another radio network, and then he bought another TV network, and then he bought another TV, another newspaper. And when he reached the point where he owned the media that reached 95% of all Italians, then Silvio Berlusconi ran for prime minister. And guess what? He won! Actually, you know, his party ran. He ran his party and they selected him. Indeed. So, our Berlusconi alert for the day this morning. Mr. Berlusconi used to describe himself as Napoleon, says the BBC. But today, he went on to complain that he feels like what he called the Jesus Christ of Italian politics. He says, I am a patient victim. I put up with everything. I sacrifice myself for everyone. Yes, Silvio Berlusconi, he says, he is just like Jesus.
Oh, stand from that day.
Our Berlusconi alert for the day. Alec DeBro, of the International Labor Communications Association, ILCA Online. Alec DeBro, the media coordinator with us. Hey, Alec, welcome to the program.
Hi there, Tom. Yes, Berlusconi is a little appalling, but he's theirs. We got our own problems, right?
Well, it's a cautionary tale, really, to America, because since Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Act and Bush and Clinton signed the Telecommunications Act,
right,
we're not that far away from the possibility of the same thing happening here in the United States.
Well, let's just take the problem we have in front of us. It's true that. And let me tell you a quick labor anecdote before we move on to the topic.
Sure.
This morning in the Washington Post is a full-page ad, headline, The New Union Label, then a picture of a chain-link fence with a lock on it, and it says closed. Under it says, brought to you by the union leaders who helped bankrupt steel, auto, and airline companies.
Yeah, it was a full-page ad in the Wall Street Journal today as well, I saw.
Okay. And
what is this? Who are these people?
Kind of funny. The Center for Union Facts. So I'm walking to work today, and we're in the AFL-CIO building, and right out in front are these people, or at least three of them, and a blow-up triceratops, which is supposed to indicate the fossilized and antediluvian nature of the AFL-CIO. Some people may agree with them, but nevertheless, there they were. So I walked up, and I said, are you guys with the ad? And they said, yeah. And I said, well, who's paying for you? And they wouldn't say. And I don't know what happened to me, Tom, but that's invective. This vulgarity came out of my mouth at that point.
Oh, Alec.
I don't, you know, I've got to go for anger management.
Yeah, you said some words you can't say on the radio.
Right? That's true, and there aren't very many left, but there they were. And I went in, I looked
you,
up.
You said to them something like what Dick Cheney said to Pat Leahy on the Senate floor?
Yeah, not quite that direct.
Okay.
But
yeah.
Yes, it was exactly like that. Anyway, I looked up their website, and they say, Union Facts, the facts they don't want you to know. Well, first of all, people don't even know the facts we want them to know,
right,
let alone the ones we don't. Anyway, on this website, it says who we are, contact us. It has nothing but a post office box and a phone number. No address, no names, no organizations, no nothing. So it's kind of fascinating. The only good thing is, obviously, we're getting to them somehow. If all they can do is trot out the figures of a couple of highly paid union presidents, they're not on very firm ground here.
Yeah. There has been a war against organized labor going on in this country ever since organized labor first started organizing in the early 1800s. And it's going to continue. I mean, there are always going to be those people who believe that aristocracy is the most stable form of government, and that labor has no right to organize itself, and we should simply be content to be peons as they continue with their trickle down economics.
That's true. I mean, they have really demeaned the nature of a worker and workplaces altogether,
yeah.
Which leads us into this quick story here. I guess we'll have to be quick now on worker training.
Mm-hmm.
And how there's a story on the budget, which I'm sure you've gotten to in various different aspects. But this one, job training. The federal budget cut job training by $500 million. Dislocated worker training cut by $200 million. Federal aid to states for job training, including funding to train veterans, cut by $300 million.
Mm-hmm.
What they announced, the Department of Labor announced at the time of Bush's, I think it was the State of the Union or sometime around that, yeah, they announced something new called WIRED, Workforce and Innovation in Regional Economic Development. I think what they're really good at is producing acronyms. I think
yeah.
The Department of Acronym got a budget.
The Department of Acronym Departments.
Yes,
yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
So all told, they reduced it by $500 million. Now they're saying the U.S. Department of Labor, here a fanfare, will invest $195 million in 13 regional economies. That's $15 million for each economy. In order to train, what they're saying is Bush's competitive agenda.
Here's what baffles me, Alec, is no matter how well trained you are, if there's no job there, I mean, we're graduating people from college with degrees and they can't get jobs. Forget about the blue-collar job. I mean, don't forget about it, literally. But, I mean, everybody says, well, you know, the blue-collar jobs are going away. Go for a white-collar. They're all going away.
Well, in part, that's true, but there are still, for instance, there are good-paying jobs in the service economy. We don't think of them very often, but, for instance, auto mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we still, for the moment, we all have cars. They all have to be fixed.
Yeah.
We don't train people in that. We don't do very much. I ran across an article about a German guy who was here. And he said, in the U.S., among people who are employed, you often encounter shocking incompetence. And he said one of the reasons is, for instance, in Germany, in order to open a auto repair shop, you need a 3-year apprenticeship to become a car mechanic.
Right.
And then you have to work as a car mechanic. Well, these training programs.
And the reason for that, by the way, is because those are the requirements of the car mechanics union.
In part, but not...
I mean, they're the ones who got the legislation passed.
They got the legislation passed, but it also, this kind of training that you get. And by the way, the important thing is this training is paid for by industry and government. In other words,
right.
You don't have to attend the Acme School of Car Mechanics and take out, $30,000 in loans in order to do it.
Right.
This is paid. The society decides they want, competent mechanics. We need them. We certainly do. And so they pay for it. It's fascinating. But it also, like, for instance, policemen in the United States get 6 months of training. In Germany, they get 3 years. All of this is, of course, paid for on it.
Right.
So, but, the one thing that we have to realize is training. It's true we have lost a great many industrial jobs. But they're also, the United States is importing foreigners to work in a lot of jobs because in many cases, in fact, they can't get the people with the skill levels they want. Mm-hmm. But they are unwilling to pay for it. This new program, the Wired program, they are doing something called the Career Advancement Accounts. Elaine Chao said they're going to give $3.4 billion to 800,000 workers nationwide. They get a grant of $3,000 to retrain themselves in any new skills for the job. It's like, here's $3,000, pay for law school.
Yeah, right.
I mean, the fact that they're cutting this stuff by a few hundred million, it was so insufficient to begin with that it's like those welfare ones. Why are those people getting second jobs? You know, what do you do with the $200 I give you last October?
It's grim.
Fumed up today.
And people can learn all about it. They can read all about it by going to www.ilca online. Be sure to add the word online, ilcaonline.org. Right?
Thank you, Tom.
Okay, good talking to you. Alec DeBro, the media coordinator for the International Labor Communications Association, ilcaonline.org. It's 16 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Truth and common sense in broadcasting for a change. Tom Hartman here with you, 21 minutes past the hour. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Scott in San Diego, California on the line. Hey, Scott, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom. Good morning. It's always great talking with you.
Thank you.
A couple of some feedback from the field out here. First of all, it took me four times to get through to Barbara Boxer. The Capitol switchboard connected me. I called each line, but after I got into Boxer's office, it would ring busy and then stop.
Hmm.
So I asked, when I finally did get through, I asked the guy there, are they getting a lot of phone calls? He said, yes. Is it about the Patriot Act? He said, yes. Is it about filibustering? He said, yes. And I said, add my name to that list.
Okay.
So
good on you, Scott.
And the other thing is, I learned yesterday, I'm a Unitarian Universalist, and we have, after service on Sundays, we have a personal journey meeting together. And this time we talked about voting and getting the homeless to vote. And the mm-hmm. person that taught us this did a lot of research and put herself on the street for a while and got very involved in this. She now lectures at high schools and colleges about this, and her goal is to get each person that hears this to get 10 more people involved.
Mm-hmm.
Here's how the homeless vote. Let's say that I live at 5th and Market. So the post office, I would register on my voting registration that I'm at 5th and Market. And if I'm there, the postman will come by and say, Scott in San Diego, I have some mail for you. If I'm not in my corner when the postman comes by, I can always go to the post office to pick up my mail.
Mm-hmm.
And in that way, I can register to vote and receive a vote-by-mail pamphlet or go to the polling place if I want to, because my legal address is Market and 5th.
Oh, that's interesting, because I know, for example, here in Oregon, where we have vote-by-mail, and also in a lot of, in Georgia, for example, this new rule, I thought that those rules were essentially making it very, very difficult for the homeless to vote, because you had to show proof of residency. You had to have, utility bill or whatever. At least not here in Oregon, but in Georgia, the new rules. And if you're homeless, you don't have a utility bill.
Exactly. And I was interested, and she was very specific on this entire process.
You're talking about how it works in California, because each state creates their own unique set of standards. Yeah. Fascinating.
I was able to do something else just for a moment, Tom, because, you don't always read the emails, but I know I can comment online. She had continued to talk about democracy and the value of our democracy, and very briefly she had mentioned, the Boston Tea Party and unfair taxes. Well, because of you and the books you've written in your program, I was able to tell people in the room that actually what we were protesting was an absence of taxes and the destruction of our own competition. I just kind of summarized what you said very briefly. And I had told them that, and everybody was very interested in that, and it really opened up the discussion. In addition, because of your show, Tom, I was able to provide them with all the numbers for the Capitol switchboard so they, too, could call senators, congresspeople, Dick Cheney, George Bush, whomever.
Cool. Good on you, Scott.
Thank you.
Keep up the good work. And the toll-free number for Congress, 888-355-3588. And you can call your senator and say, please filibuster the Patriot Act. We would really rather not have Big Brother in our face. I mean, we'd really, really not have it. Jerry in Detroit, Michigan. Hey, Jerry.
Hi. Wanted to talk about SCI, Service Corporation International, and the John Waltrip gang.
Oh, yeah. This is the big funeral company that George W. Bush got tied up in 1998-99 in Texas. It nearly brought down his governorship. It was, they called it Funeral Gate. And the way he got out of it, apparently, was appointing the guy that Dick Cheney just shot to be the head of the funeral commission.
Oh, the same guy? Oh, okay, that's a little more than I knew. But I knew, see, what it was, there was a body that was leaking in church, and they were fined, and the lady that was, like, the director of the funeral commission wouldn't release the fine, or wouldn't, you know, lift up on it. Bush pressured her and fired her for not...
That's right, and then she sued as a whistleblower, and that's what blew the whole thing up in 98.
Okay, and see, one thing, that was the same F...
But she dropped her case. She settled out of court. She dropped her case and settled out of court when this guy who was just shot, who's already, I've forgotten his name, I don't have it right in front of me.
The international part is another key thing to their name.
Yeah.
They're the guys that were responsible for stacking bodies like cordwood down in Florida, not cremating.
Georgia. It was Georgia. Yeah.
Well, I think there was different stories.
Yeah.
What they do is they go around, they buy up family-owned funeral homes, and it's like, and they keep the old names on them.
Yeah, and then get a monopoly in the market and start jacking the prices up.
Yeah, so there's no competition in price. So pre-need shopping around is something that's imperative.
Yeah, yeah, that's for sure. Yeah, be sure, you know, if you think you're going to die, or, you know, even not, you know, be looking at that. But Dana in LeConnor, Washington. Hey, Dana, we just have a few seconds left. What's up?
Well, it's a quick question, and it's about the vice president's hunting accident. And I'm wondering why, when the man who shot the vice president, or who the vice president shot, came up behind him, which is what all the reports say, why was he shot in the face?
Well, apparently he was walking toward the president, or the vice president.
And the president turns and pivots and shoots him in the face?
That's, I guess, what they would have you believe.
Because he's walking up behind him, so he's coming up on the vice president's back, so he must have pivoted around and just shot.
Yeah. I still have the question, you know, why did it take 24 hours for them to report this, and why was the vice president unwilling to talk to the local police when that's the law? The law is that if there's a gunshot wound, if somebody suffers a gunshot wound, the police have to interview the person who fired the shot. And the vice president refused to do that, and this was not reported for 24 hours. And that's the kind of little game that you see people play with hit and runs when they're drunk. And I just want to know, what is the vice president trying to hide here? And from whom is he trying to hide? Obviously from all the rest of us, I'd say. 27 minutes past the hour. Thanks, Dana, for the call. Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends, to your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. It's every Monday we like to take a look at the week back, at what's going on right now, at the week forward, with a couple of folks from the media who can give us some insights into what about the best of the rest of the news? What is going on with all this? We have with us today Vanessa Cirelli, who is the associate editor, assistant editor at CommonDreams.org, and Joan Claybrook at Public Citizen. She's the president of Public Citizen, citizen.org, the website. Joan Claybrook, welcome. Let me start with you. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
And Vanessa, welcome also to the program.
Thanks, Tom.
Glad to have you both with us. Joan, you have on your homepage the Ethics Hall of Shame, Congressman Tom DeLay. And I'm wondering, to what extent do you think that this story is meta to the larger story of Republican corruption in general, or just corruption in general? I mean, but particularly the Abramoff thing and its association with Republicans, and is this going to carry into 2006, or do you think the Republicans are going to be able to make us sufficiently afraid that we'll forget about this?
Well, that's the story, and it's unclear how it's going to play out. But I think the public is very disgusted with the abuse and the fraud and the scandals that have been going on. And the Republicans have been stealing from the federal treasury for their campaign contributors and for the lobbyists corporate lobbyists. Well, they've been giving, you know, special deals and tax breaks and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all paid for out of the federal treasury, and then they get the campaign contributions to run for reelection and try and keep their majority.
Right.
And that's the game. There's a lot of push since Abramoff scandal broke, and particularly since he pleaded guilty. And he's also ratting to the feds in order to keep himself out of jail.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Republicans are definitely scared. There's a big split in the Republican Party in the House, particularly about whether or not to do something in terms of reforms that are significant. And actually, I don't think most members of Congress really want these reforms, but the Democrats have been pushing much harder, for sure, both in the House and in the Senate.
Yeah.
The key issues are, for example, in terms of reforms, is whether or not travel on corporate jets is going to be banned. And for many members of Congress, this is now considered an entitlement.
Oh, really?
Yes.
It's just a very absolutely common thing.
Common thing. And they pay first-class fare equivalent to do it.
Right.
But, of course, the cost for a private jet is probably 20 or 30 times the first-class fare.
Yeah, yeah.
So maybe $26,000, they pay $1,000, something of that sort.
Incredible. I know, for example, Peter DeFazio, one of our congressmen here in Oregon, is just, you know, he's flying on United all the time.
Right.
You see him out there, you know.
Right. But a lot of members, and particularly those who can't get direct flights,
mm-hmm.
they don't want to stand in line. They don't want to take the time to transfer planes.
They're big shots.
They're big shots.
Yeah.
And so that's a key issue.
So you see corruption as the big issue right now, and you think that it's going to have some legs.
Well, I don't know if it's the big issue for each individual congressional race and so on and so
mm-hmm.
forth in 06, but definitely in the Congress, they're going to try and do something. They're going to try and do something in the next 4 months. So time is of the essence in trying to make sure it's serious. And the other key issue is the relationship between lobbyists and money. Right now, lobbyists bundle money for members of Congress. That is, they go collect funds from a lot of other friends and people. They have events and parties for them. They often serve as campaign treasurers. Members hate to raise money, but they need money and want money.
Right.
And so when anyone comes up and says, Joe, I'd like to have an event for you. We're going to raise you, $50,000. Is that okay? Sure. Right?
Yeah, well, and this is the whole pioneer thing and all of that. Joan Claybrook, president of Public Citizen, citizen.org. Vanessa Cirilli, the assistant editor of Common Dreams, commondreams.org. Vanessa, I'm wondering what you see as the top story of the day, the big issue right in front of us now.
Well, segueing actually right from from corruption is probably the king of corruption, the WTO. I want to talk about the WTO biotech ruling with Europe.
Mm-hmm.
This is has probably not been talked about that much, but it's something that...
Yeah, we mentioned on this program last week, the WTO just said that Europe has to accept our genetically modified products, and Europe is pushing back and saying, no, we don't think so.
Right, right. Well, this all started, the long simmering dispute centers on a 2003 complaint brought by the U.S., Canada, Argentina, and at the time, Egypt, all major producers of GM crops. Not Egypt is a major producer, but the U.S. and Argentina are.
Mm-hmm.
And the countries claim that the EU's six-year de facto ban on GM products, beginning in, it was about 1998 when they adopted what's called the United Nations Cartagena Protocol on Biosafety, which says basically that any country can just decide, look, we don't think this is okay. We're going to wait and see what actually happens with these particular bio crops and seeds and stuff. So we're just going to wait. We're not going to import anything until
it's essentially the precautionary principle being played out.
Precautionary is exactly right. Right. So there, So the U.S. is saying, well, no, we don't really want this to happen. Basically, what's happening is the majority of the bio, tech seeds or whatever, the GM seeds are being produced here in the U.S., which is without the EU purchasing this or the food.
So how is this being played out, Vanessa? What's going to happen? Is the WTO going to impose its will on the EU and we're going to be able to, the United States is going to be able to sell these products over there? Or is the EU going to push back, or are we going to see the beginning of the unraveling of the WTO?
Oh, well, God, that would be great, wouldn't it? But I don't, you know, it's hard to say what's going on with the WTO in the future. I don't know. They're starting to lose a lot of credibility very quickly. But really what's happening is that the U.S. has already, the WTO has already ruled in favor of the U.S. and that what the EU is pulling with the precautionary principle is illegal, is what they're saying. Mm-hmm. According to an article, actually, in Interpress Service by Imad McKay that we published just late last week.
Mm-hmm.
And so the U.S. is basically trying to push through, make the EU buy and eat these genetically modified foods.
Right.
Well,
so far without success.
So far without success. However, now that it's considered, quote, illegal by the World Trade Organization, which, you know, the panel that was deciding this particular case that the U.S. brought to the WTO, it's only three people. It's three.
They always are, aren't they?
Three, pardon?
Aren't they? Aren't the panels always three people, and they
right,
can be members of industry?
Right.
Yeah, they're
unelected, secretly appointed tribunal. Right.
Right.
Someone from it was like India, Japan, Switzerland.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it's just these three people who really have no experience in deciding what's going on in terms of the environmental implications of what could really happen with genetically modified food.
Right.
So, you know,
so is the bottom line, Vanessa, that we don't know how this is going to play out, but we need to be keeping our attention on it? We need to be paying attention to it?
Well, absolutely, yeah. And, I mean, the global ramifications are huge. The biggest impact of the trade dispute goes well beyond Europe or the U.S. The case serves as kind of a warning to other countries by mm-hmm. the U.S., particularly developing ones,
yeah.
you know, not to just restrict access to
yeah,
the
this
market.
Yeah, you're right. This is a huge issue. I'm running Joan Claybrook, Public Citizen. Does Public Citizen get involved in GMO issues?
Not in GMO, but we get involved in the WTO in many, many different aspects, also NAFTA, so we're certainly involved in that.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to mention one thing that's hot this week on the floor of the House, or the Senate, rather, if you have a minute or...
Well, we have 2.5 minutes left, yeah.
Well, this is very brief. It's the bill to limit the ability of people who have been injured by asbestos to go to court and get any
remedy. My father has mesothelioma right now. I'm personally very concerned about that.
Well, this bill is a big bailout for the asbestos manufacturers and
That's
user
right.
companies. And there's a key vote on the Senate floor tomorrow because an issue is being raised about whether it exceeds the budget resolution. And it's a technical point, but in fact, the bill will... everyone predicts will not be sufficient money there to pay people, even within the very narrow parameters of this bill. They don't allow, for example, in most cases, you know, have a CAT scan, you can only have an X-ray. I mean, there are many outrageous provisions in this bill.
Right.
I just wanted to mention the members of the Senate who are going to be the swing votes on whether or not this bill is killed or not.
Okay.
Can I do that? Is that
Please.
All right? Senator Landrieu of Louisiana,
mm-hmm.
and, for example, this bill doesn't allow any recovery for environmental asbestos exposure, despite Katrina, where asbestos is all over the place.
Right.
Blanche Lincoln of Arkansas, Evan Bayh of Indiana, Tom Carper of Delaware, Byron Dorgan of North Dakota, and Ben Nelson of Nebraska. Those are some key Democrats.
And let me add that they can be called toll-free at 888-355-3588. That'll get you right through to the Capitol switchboard.
Oh, wonderful. Well, why don't you say that again?
888-355-3588. Toll-free to Congress.
These members are on the fence, and also Ken Salazar of Colorado. So I'm hoping that the listeners will be as angry about this as I am. It's a bill that Senator Specter, who's usually pretty moderate, has decided he wanted to push,
mm-hmm.
and he's the chairman of the Judiciary Committee. And it's very unfortunate because people who have been exposed to asbestos will probably never be able to recover anything, or if at best a very small amount.
No, the winners here are Halliburton and other companies that are deeply involved in the asbestos industry.
That's so right. They're
just
the
very simple bottom line.
And the losers are the people.
That's right. Joan Claybrook, president of Public Citizen, citizen.org, and Vanessa Cirilli, the assistant editor of Common Dreams, commondreams.org. Thank you both for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
It's great speaking with you, and great websites. Be sure to check it out, citizen.org and commondreams.org. It's 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman here on the True People's Radio.
is the Tom Hartman Program.
So take the photographs and still frames in your mind. Hanging on a shelf in good health and good time. Tattoos and memories and asking on trial. For what it's worth, it was worth all the while. It's
something welcome back, my friends.
But in the end is right.
It's the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. A place where smart people get their news.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync. You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
Maybe CityWatcher.com, a private video surveillance company, said it was testing the technology as a way of controlling access to a room where it holds security video footage for government agencies and the police. What technology? This from the Financial Times of London. An Ohio company has embedded silicon chips in two of its employees. The first known case in which U.S. workers have been tagged electronically as a way of identifying them. Yes, this is not the Borowitz report. This is from the Financial Times. Liz McIntyre, who campaigns against the use of identification technology, RFID chips, says there are very serious privacy and civil liberties issues of having people permanently numbered. The technology's defenders say it's acceptable as long as it's not compulsory, but critics say any implanted device could be used to track the wearer without their knowledge. So far, around 70 people in the U.S. have had the implants, the company says. Yeah. Amazing. So that falls into the strange news of the day, into the good news or the interesting news of the day. Senator George Allen, Republican of Virginia, here in an interchange over the weekend on Fox News with Jack Reed, the Democrat of Rhode Island, and good old what's-his-name, Chris Wallace. Well, here it starts out with Reed.
I think it's inappropriate. I think it's wrong. And I think that this calls into question in terms of Fitzpatrick's investigation. Mr. Fitzgerald's investigation.
Now, keep in mind what Reed, this is Jack Reed, the Democrat from Rhode Island, what he's saying is wrong is the allegation by Mr. Fitzgerald, the prosecutor in the case, that the source of permission, but not even permission, that basically the Scooter Liberty is saying that Dick Cheney told him to do it, told him to release classified information, told him to leak classified information, which is illegal. So you've got the Democrat, which, you know, no surprise, Jack Reed, the Democrat from Rhode Island, saying, yeah, this is wrong, this is illegal. And here's where it gets a little more interesting.
The conduct of the vice president and others, perhaps. And I think he has to look closely at their behavior. And again, it just seems to me that...
You're saying he should be investigating the vice president?
Well, whoever the superiors are that are supposedly, allegedly leaked or authorized to leak by individual in question, Mr. Libby, I think the investigation has to go forward.
Okay, now Chris Wallace turns to the Republican, George Allen, Republican senator from Virginia.
Senator Allen?
The prosecutor here, Mr. Fitzgerald, seems to me to be a very articulate, professional prosecutor. And I think the facts will lead wherever they lead, and I think he will prosecute as appropriate. I don't think anybody should be releasing classified information, period, whether in the Congress, executive branch, or some underling in some bureaucracy.
Whoa! A Republican on Fox News just said that what Dick Cheney did shouldn't be done? Amazing. And, you know, maybe Dick Cheney shot that guy just to change the story about him. Because this, I mean, here we're talking about a crime being committed. And, well, now everybody just wants to talk about, you know, is it bird shot or buckshot? Did he get shot, you know, on the side of the face or the front of the face? Was Dick Cheney drinking or not? And, you know, what, you know, none of that stuff is going to get Cheney impeached. None of that stuff is going to get Cheney's butt thrown in jail. This stuff could. Dick Cheney telling Scooter Libby to go out and break the laws of the United States, violate the intelligence laws of the United States, release classified information. We're talking a serious crime. Can you imagine how the Republicans would be, how they would be hyperventilating right now if Bill Clinton had released classified information instead of just having sex with that woman? In the meantime, we find that Mr. Poindexter's program apparently lives on. This is from the Think Progress site. General Michael Hayden was asked whether the Total Information Awareness Office, TIA, right, Poindexter's brainchild, the We Know Everything About You, the program was continuing. Senator Ron Wyden, Democrat of Oregon, I and others on this panel led the effort to close it, Total Information Awareness. We want to know if Mr. John Poindexter's programs are going on somewhere else. Can you answer that? Hayden, Senator, I'd like to answer in closed session. What? Well, as Newsweek points out, today, very quietly, the core of TIA survives with a new code name of Topsail, minus the futures market. The, basically, all he did was get rid of this nutty idea that John Poindexter had of let's have a futures market on terror. You can bet on when the next terrorist attack is going to be. Two officials privy to the intelligence tell Newsweek, it is truly Poindexter's brainchild. Of all the people, remember, Poindexter was once, you know, charged with felonies during the Reagan administration. It is, of all the people in the intelligence business, he has the keenest appreciation of using advanced information and technology for intelligence gathering, says John Arcula, an intelligence expert at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. Poindexter lives just outside Washington, Rockville, Maryland. Could not be reached for comment on whether he is still involved with Topsail. Yeah. So Congress says, no, you can't have Total Information Awareness Office. And so Poindexter says, okay, cool. We'll change its name. Congress? We don't need those thinking Congress. Coming up on the next Tom Hartman program, is the meaning of conservative now just loyalty to Bush? Why are voting machine examiners refusing to testify? As the Arctic ice retreats, is the old international geopolitical great game heating up? That and more, and your questions tomorrow on the Tom Hartman radio program, The Real Democracy Zone. Remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.